supreme event to wait. It will indeed go down in history as a decisive point in the world's development. All events have become subordinate in these days to the complete collapse of France. On Monday afternoon, I was several hundred miles away from Berlin in certain military headquarters. I had been learning certain facts from a group of officers whose chief was an old soldier who knew England well. It was a delightful afternoon, bathed in sunshine, and we were taking a rest after some rather arduous exercise. Then we were suddenly surprised by the entry into the room of another officer who informed us that a Sondermeldung, that is to say, an announcement of special significance, was to be expected over the radio in a short time. The senior officer present tuned in. I looked out on the beautiful countryside and the rich green of the luxuriant trees. The air was pure and invigorating, and I felt as if I'd had a month's holiday at the seaside. We went on discussing our business, and then the music, it was, I think, the overture to Rienzi, suddenly stopped. And we heard that an announcement of far-reaching importance was going to be made in a few minutes. We wondered what it could be. In our own minds, of course, the thought of French capitulation was insistent, but it seemed a little early. We knew that it would come soon, but to hope that the breakdown of French resistance would be announced in a few minutes seemed a little premature. Perhaps some new and decisive victory had been won. Perhaps then the first strains of the Wacht am Rhein floated through the room. So it had to do with France, after all. Again the motif sounded, and again. We looked at the receiving set intently, as people will, quite unnecessarily, but naturally. Then the message came. Marshal Pétain had stated in a broadcast to the French people that France must lay down arms as the struggle would be no longer sustained. He had asked the head of the German state to make known the conditions of an armistice. The Führer was to consult the Duce on the answer which was to be made to this request. Then the sacred German hymn, Deutschland über alles, began. We all stood up reverently and silently thanked our God for this great victory and the relief that it must bring to millions. There were several veterans present, wearing the orders and decorations which they had won on the field of battle. They mastered their emotions like the strong men they were. And then the famous horse vessel leaped. The great National Socialist march crashed out. I thought of all that it had meant during the last painful years of German resurrection, and the National Socialist fighters who had fallen, that Germany might once again be great, of the Führer's own miraculous efforts, of the meeting, the organization, the house-to-house work, the imprisonment, the ordeal, which had all contributed to the shaping of a new and glorious nation. And above all, I wished for the old campaigners who had been carried silently home when their work was done might be living to hear these words of history. The music stopped and we looked at each other for a moment in silence. Yes, it was an experience never to be forgotten. I had intended to stay longer, but it was now necessary to finish the task at once. A rapid phone call to Berlin, a few hours of steady work, and I was rushing through the night
back to the capital of Great Deutschland. The people of Berlin took the news with calm gratitude. They were happy and proud. But there was no exultation. Rather, there was the clear consciousness of a work to be completed. The general attitude was, yes, we are indeed thankful for this great victory. We want to celebrate. But there will come a time for the celebration of our lives in the near future, when the warmongers of England are laid low and our German peace is safe forever. Great scenes of enthusiasm were witnessed in Munich when the Führer and the Duce met to discuss the answer to Marshal Pétain. Munich, the birthplace of the National Socialist Movement, the city where the Führer had once set out with seven men to unify and restore a nation of 80 million, the city through whose streets he had walked, unknown after the shame of Versailles. Munich, the city from which Mr. Chamberlain had brought peace to England in September 1938, a peace which he undermined systematically by substituting hostility for all his pledges of concord and amity. In those days, Munich had a special significance for England. The millions of Londoners who lined the streets and cheered Chamberlain on his return, then saw it as the city of peace. And so it was seen by its own citizens on this historic occasion. Had Chamberlain and his colleagues only been true to the spirit of the welcome that the British people gave to the news which came on that famous Friday afternoon in the early English autumn, men would be living today whose bones are now rotting. But it was not to be. Meanwhile, there was no cessation of hostilities. Had the French desired one, they could have had it by unconditional surrender. That was a matter for Marshal Pétain. Our armies left Paris far behind. With irresistible strength, they swept down south. One victory after another was announced. Lyon, Dijon, Cherbourg, and Brest were captured. The historic city of Strasbourg became German once again. Success followed success with dizzy rapidity. At times, the whole thing seemed almost incomprehensible. One never knew what fresh loss was to be added to the achievement of our troops. On Thursday, I was driving outside of Berlin with a friend when we heard the famous Baden-Weiler march from the radio on our car. This march is always associated with the personal presence and appearance of the Führer. We wondered what it betokened on this occasion. After a while, we heard the news that Baden-Weiler, a place in Alsace, had been captured. It was the place associated with the Führer's personal march. On the next day, the Führer went to the chief of the German forces and the foreign minister of the Reich into the forest of Compiègne. There also entered these woods the representatives of the French Republic. At approximately 3:30 on the afternoon of June the 21st, the discussions concerning the armistice began. It was here that in November 1918, the terms of disgrace and all the evil that ensued from them were imposed on Germany. It was here that Marshal Foch, curtly and sardonically, asked the German delegates what they expected from him. It was in the very same railway carriage that the dictates of oppression and conquest were made known to the Germans, in flat violation of all the promises whereby President Wilson had persuaded the unbeaten German forces to lay down their arms. On this occasion, however, the delegates of the defeated nation were welcomed by a military guard of honor. They were personally greeted by the Führer, who, as the head of the state, might well have awaited their salutations. He had taken particular care that no dishonorable association should attach to this meeting with a vanquished but gallant foe. The French representatives were allowed facilities, which were abruptly denied to the German delegates of 1918. For example, they were unable to communicate by telephone with our government. And it is clear that they were not rushed in their deliberations. Fortunately for them, they had to deal with a chivalrous soldier and a statesman too great for any pettiness of mind or conduct. It was made plain to them the object of the negotiations was to procure permanent peace between France and Germany, to redress the wrongs which Germany had suffered in the past, and to give Germany security in the war, which the British government insists on pursuing to the bitter end. And bitter it will be for England. Even as the world awaited the results of these discussions in the forest of Compiègne, the question, what next, was already in millions of minds. To the curious, a sufficient indication should be given by the fact that Germany, settling with France, is taking all necessary precautions to ensure that a complete settlement with England shall be possible in the very near future. We waited for the news, and then, last night, we learned that the German-French officers had been signed at 6:50 p.m. For the English people, the complete collapse of French resistance after mere 6 weeks of fighting ought to be a salutary warning. The French forces were better trained, better equipped, and more numerous than the British. And the defeat of France within 6 weeks after the entry of German troops into Belgium and Holland is the most eloquent testimony as to what Germany can do in modern warfare. It needs no stressing. The bare fact is so gigantic as almost to pass comprehension. Churchill, the dictator of Britain, is interested solely in the old world of Jewish international finance. If he can't save that, if he won't, he wants to save nothing but his own skin. In the face of certain defeat, he is exposing Britain to invasion and the horrors of war. The old campaign of lies about German weakness continues in England, unabated. The people seem like dumb, driven animals, unable to speak with a voice of their own. Patriotic Englishmen are in prison because they dare to see and recommend the wisdom of peace. And so, even as peace dawns over the French people, twilight spreads over England, and in the night of our sorrow, the men who have ruined and betrayed her will slip away and leave the people to their fate.